We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 134.
On today's show, we talk about decapitated Roman burials, lava tubes filled with bones, and an ancient mint.
Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to the show, everyone. How you doing?
Hello.
So you may hear some fan sounds, and I'm going to tell you, I don't care.
Yeah.
It's hot.
It's very hot.
Everywhere we've been, we're currently in northwestern Washington, and even here, where I grew up, it's usually nice and cool. We left the eastern side of the state, where it was over 100 for the last 5 days.
Yep.
And we get here, and it's still 100. But tomorrow, to be fair, it's going to be like 80.
Yeah, it's dropping. We're just in a little mini heat wave. Nothing like they had last month, so.
No, so.
But yeah, we did chase the cool weather and apparently brought the heat with us.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
So, okay. So let's talk archaeology. We've got a few articles here to talk about.
Let's.
That's right. So I don't want to get ahead of myself.
Oh.
Though.
Okay. Oh.
All right. So this first article, exceptionally high number of decapitated bodies found at Roman burial site. First off, I like that. It's exceptionally high. Not that they were surprised to find decapitations.
Right.
Like, that was expected.
Yeah, that's unusual.
It's just a higher than usual number.
Right.
Which I'm like, that is messed up, Romans.
Well, I mean, how else are they supposed to execute their criminals?
I mean, you know, reform them? I don't know. But you're probably right. We should probably do more beheadings.
It just wasn't, like, as forgiving of a civilization than ours. Can be.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
Anyway,
that's true.
I get it. And I think if I remember correctly, when we were talking about Sutton Hoo earlier this year, there was a burial there that had a lot of decapitated bodies as well. And they were just assuming, like they are with this one, I'm kind of giving it away, but they're assuming that it has something to do with, you know, judicial executions.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So the article we're reading, we're linking to, is from CNN, actually. We may link to the New York Times article as well, but New York Times irritates me because I don't subscribe to it on a normal basis. So if you hit 10 articles in your lifetime, apparently, you can no longer read anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just blocks you. That's so annoying.
Luckily, they didn't invent this story. They just parroted it like everybody else did. So we found it on CNN. But it was also published in the Cambridge University Press's Britannia Journal. So if you want to go find that. So there were 17 decapitated bodies at three Roman cemeteries in Cambridgeshire, England. And they say this high number may be the result, as Rachel said, of judicial executions. I'm going to jump down on my notes here. It says that during the latter part of the Roman occupation of Britain, the number of crimes carrying the death penalty increased from 14 to 60. Like, we know they have laws. So
yeah. So we know that there's a lot of things that people could have been executed for, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's just crazy, knowing that there's 60 laws you could potentially break.
Yeah.
Like, 14 sounds like a reasonable number. Like, those are pretty bad things you could probably do that, I don't know, most people would probably argue may deserve the death penalty in that sort of time frame.
Mm-hmm.
But 60? It's
60's a lot.
What are those rules? And do you even know that you're breaking them?
Right.
And all of a sudden you're like, oh, I did that thing. Yep, you're going to lose your head. So.
Yeah. No, this is really interesting, though. They found 52 burials at the one spot called Knobs Farm in Somersham.
Mm-hmm.
And 13 of them were buried face down, which I thought was really interesting. Because they're postulating that they were buried that way because they were criminals. And so it was like a way to shame them even in death is to bury them face down.
Or that the family was ashamed of them.
Or that the family was ashamed of them. Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
probably both, though.
Yeah, probably a bit of both. Yeah. So I thought that was interesting. And it adds more credence to the theory that they are executions and not just, you know, I don't know. Why else would you have a whole bunch of decapitated bodies with no other wounds on the body? So it wasn't like it was from a war or a battle or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It says heads of some of the decapitated bodies were placed at their feet And based on morphology, you can tell like how the cut happened. You can tell that some of them were kneeling when they died. So clearly execution style.
Oh, I was going to ask, how would they know that they were on their knees when they died?
I would imagine it's the angle of the cut vertebrae.
Coming from above, probably. Yeah.
Because it would have been, I guess, depending on how you're sitting, usually you see the head bowed. Mm-hmm. Solely placing all this information on like movies.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
The head's bowed and it's down and then somebody's coming from up top. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it depends on, you know, I wonder, this is a morbid thought, but in rock paintings, you can often determine the handedness of the person.
Oh, okay.
And I wonder if you could determine that, like it's almost a signature, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if in like popular Roman towns, because there weren't too many executioners,
mm-hmm.
if these people were documented, I would be like, oh, this looks like the work of Ralph, totally.
Oh, you're probably right about that. Like, if that person has been documented, but that's the problem, is that this is too long ago to have good documentation of who the town executioner was.
We knew exactly which laws went from, you know, no death penalty to death penalty.
That's true.
So
that's true.
The Romans wrote that down.
Yeah.
And I'm like, the thing I'm wondering about is you do have handedness in swinging an axe, basically, or mm-hmm. the kind of thing they would have swung to chop heads off.
Right.
Which is basically axe-like. And I would imagine the angle, the height of the person versus, you know, the people that they're chopping heads off of for,
mm-hmm.
all those kinds of things. But how do they know that some of these weren't guillotined? I guess they didn't exactly say that either.
Well, guillotine wasn't even invented yet. So.
I don't know when it was invented. Well, it's a French word, too.
It's French. I think it was invented I'm speaking off the cuff completely right now, but I'm pretty sure it was invented by the French kings in like the 1700s or whatever. So
yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, another interesting thing was some of the remains a lot of the remains were in poor condition. And they used a term that I guess I knew exactly what it was, but I hadn't really seen written down before.
Uh-huh.
Sand shadows.
Yeah.
Some of them were. So the bones actually completely decayed and were gone.
Very acidic soil, probably, right?
Yeah. And the only thing you were left was like the impression of the bone, because the bone doesn't decay overnight. And even if it takes only a few months, let's just say that, like, I don't know how mm-hmm. long it takes, but let's say it just takes a few months. As that bone is disappearing, so to speak, and decaying into the strata around it, it's going to be replaced with things.
Right.
You know, whether it's other minerals. And this is essentially the process of fossilization if it's the right minerals and the right amount of time and pressure and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Fossilization is a pretty rare circumstance when it comes to bones. Mm-hmm. But so I would imagine more often you're left with these sand shadow type things.
Yeah.
So
I worked on a cemetery in New Jersey, and we definitely encountered that pretty often. Like, we would have the outline of a coffin, so we knew where, cause these were much newer burials, like 1800s. Yeah. So we knew where the burial was because of the outline of the coffin. And then like the soil inside the coffin was just like different.
Yeah.
It was different. It was often clayier, if that makes sense. But there were no bones left because they had just been completely replaced
mm-hmm.
by soil. So
yeah, one kind of, I feel like, was a tongue-in-cheek sort of statement, and I don't know if this was from the person who wrote the CNN article or the actual paper, but they said with the sand shadows, they were still able to see a lack of trauma directly before death, and then there's like a little comma, you know, aside from the beheading.
Right, like the head between the legs, you know, like there's that part.
Yeah, aside from, you know, losing your head right before you died.
Right, right.
Yeah. But anyway, it was still pretty cool to not bury the lead there, that even though it was like impressions or shadows of the bones, they could still see that there was really no other visible trauma, you know, aside from that.
Which throws out the idea that this was a battle or something,
right?
Some event that caused all these people to be decapitated. It was much more likely that it was related to criminal mm-hmm. justice.
Yeah, another thing that leads to some evidence of, I mean, not that we need evidence of the Roman occupation of Britain, but the Romans were great unifiers, is a way to say it. They conquered people, and then instead of totally destroying them, they brought them into their civilization. They converted them, so to speak, and, you know, sucked them up into their empire, mm-hmm. right? So evidence of this, I think, is from the DNA evidence, and it says there was DNA evidence from 9 different groups of people from various places.
Oh, that's interesting.
That were represented.
I wonder how varied that DNA...
They executed indiscriminately.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I wonder how varied that DNA was. Like, it was it nine places around, you know, the UK area, or was it nine places around Europe?
Yeah.
Like, how?
I mean, the article doesn't really get into it.
Doesn't, no.
Yeah, but I would imagine the DNA in just England, for example, wouldn't be too different from people who were generationally born there.
Right.
But it was probably people that came with the Romans or moved there because of the Romans or, you know, whatever, and came from all over the place. So
yeah.
That was just a guess, though. Most of the remains were believed to belong to adults over the age of 25. So I guess.
Again, makes sense.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. If it were a battle or some kind of violence, then you would expect to see all ages, probably.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Some of the graves included grave goods, such as pots and, I thought it was cool, miniature pottery.
Hmm.
Goods like beakers. It said beakers.
Oh.
I'm like, beakers? Like science beakers? That's a weird thing. That must be something else.
Yeah, they probably, I mean, obviously they must have been used for something else, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A comb was found in one, and this is a little presumptuous, it said may have been in a woman's hair when she was beheaded. I'm like, well, were combs restricted to women? Are they the only ones that combed their hair? Did they have to? Is it the kind of comb that you would have left in your hair at that time?
So maybe you don't quite understand what they mean by comb.
Probably not.
So it's like there's these decorative combs that women would wear in their hair. Well, all throughout history, really, and in different places and times. But they're smaller than like the comb that you use for your hair, and there's a decorative piece on top of it, and you would basically stick that comb into whatever configuration your hair was in, a bun or up somehow, and then the decorative part would stick up out of it, usually.
So the interesting thing that tells me is that she did not languish in prison before she was executed. This was a swift, like,
probably.
We're bringing you to the executioner, like, now, get up.
Yeah.
Let's go. Because her hair was done. She had a comb in it. That wouldn't have been the case if she were in prison for weeks at a time.
Probably not. They would have stolen it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting to think. Well, and I'm intrigued by the whole, like, grave goods thing. Like, if these were criminals,
well,
why would they end
the
up with
just collected
grave
the bodies,
goods?
Though.
Yeah, it's just interesting because, like, some of the bodies are upside down, right? Prone, I think they call it, right?
Yeah.
Some of the bodies are prone. Some of the bodies have heads between their legs or at their feet or whatever. And then some of them get grave goods. So, like, is it just the level of your criminal activity determines whether or not you get grave goods and how you're buried, maybe?
Well, I think it's like a lot of crimes that are committed these days, like especially with the Romans at this time, with the sheer number of crimes, like it's illegal to the Romans, but is it illegal to the people there? Were they really ashamed that they just sad that this person's dead and they're going to bury them as honorably as they can?
Right, right.
Regardless, because it didn't say that the grave goods came from the ones that were presumably shamed. It doesn't even
specify. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah. And the other thing I was wondering here is what time frame, like what's the spread, you know, how many years is it?
It says
covering?
That the grave goods date from the third and fourth centuries AD.
So we're talking about like a century of use potentially here?
Potentially, one to two.
So that is interesting then because like things can change a lot in a century and maybe what was acceptable at one point and not shameful maybe was shameful later on and vice versa or whatever. So
yeah, totally.
It would be interesting to, I mean, you're just speculating as to what these people did and why they were decapitated before they died, but, or decapitated to die.
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway.
All right. Well, anything else on this?
No, it's super interesting though. And I bet that there's a lot of cemeteries across Roman territories that are like this. And it would be really interesting to like see like a meta study, you know, where they look at a bunch of different ones and from different time periods and just see like what was causing various types of deaths. Was it all decapitation? Were there other types of deaths that you would see at a cemetery where justice was being carried out? So anyway, interesting.
All right. Well, we are going to put a pin in this one and collect up all our little bone factoids and drop them down a lava tube. Back in a minute.
So bad.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 134. And as I mentioned, we're hitting some lava tubes. First off, we've seen lava tubes in Northern California.
Yeah, Lava Beds.
Lava Beds National Monument.
Yeah, National Monument. Yeah. That place was so cool. We didn't get to spend a lot of time there, but the geological features that are lava tubes are really interesting and really neat to explore.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. So this article, we're reading from a Heritage Daily article, but we also link to the Springer article as well from Archaeological and Anthropological Sciences, Volume 13, August 2021. The Heritage Daily article is called Thousands of Human and Animal Bones Hoarded by Hyenas in a Lava Tube System. And the pictures are something. There's just like
piles of bones.
What looked like long bones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, kind of crazy. Yeah, because, well, I mean, getting right into it, we're talking about hyenas pulling back a carcass of something to have for dinner in these tubes. And it was probably a safe place where they could eat in relative peace, right?
Yeah.
But I'm guessing that they couldn't drag an entire carcass because hyenas aren't that big. So, like, probably they were dragging, like, a leg or an... Or I mean, in the case of a human, an arm.
We'll get into hyenas.
Okay.
Because I don't know a lot about them. Changed a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually kind of did a little bit of a deep dive on hyenas.
Oh, did you? Okay,
this.
Cool.
So let's place this first, though. This is in Saudi Arabia. And it's the longest lava tube. It says Arabia's longest lava tube system. I don't know if that means Saudi Arabia or like the region
the
of
whole,
Arabia.
Like,
yeah. But anyway, it's the and I don't delete this, Chris, the editor, because it's the Jordan Lava Tube System.
Right.
UMM.
With two M's.
Yeah. is located in, it says, I hate all these names. Well, I don't hate them. I just hate that I can't pronounce them.
Right.
Herat Khabarovsk Lava Field. I don't know.
Sure.
Look at the article.
Yep.
So the project that did the research on this is called the Paleo Deserts Project, which sounds super cool.
Yeah.
They did taphonomic, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but taphonomic studies of fossil bone accumulations to track human and animal migration across the Arabian Peninsula. So taphonomic studies of fossil bone. Taphonomy is, there's basically like a five-step process for a bone going from not a fossil to a fossil. And it's first, and I don't know if I'll get all these right off the top of my head, but it's basically death and decay is the first one where tendons and things kind of break down. That's the first one. And then you've got dispersal. And dispersal can be through, you know, mechanical means like rivers and streams and stuff like that or animals. At some point, you've got the actual decay of the bone. So the bone starts to break down and mineralize.
Okay.
That's what, you know, happens to that. And I'm missing a step in here somewhere, but one of the final steps after that is after the bone becomes a fossil, there's other stuff that can happen to it. Pressure, movement, other ways. Like now it's basically just a rock, but things can still happen to it. So you have to take that into account in the life cycle. So taphonomy or taphonomic studies is the study of a bone in this entire life cycle. You know, what's happened to it throughout this whole time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
So that's kind of a cool word. I like
it. Yeah, that is neat.
Cool concept too.
It doesn't only refer to bones, right? It can be, Or is it only referring to bones?
I think it does, in this scientific case, only refer to bones.
Okay.
Which are typically the only things we study that fossilize, except for, I mean, I know, like, I guess plants don't really fossilize, do they?
No,
they have
you just get the imprints. Yeah. So I guess it would only be bones or things made, teeth and stuff like that. You
heard
know?
Of other stuff fossilizing. In fact, it's kind of a common creationist trope to talk about this, like, Texas sombrero type hat that fossilized in a stream bed or something. I don't know if that's actually real. I heard about this years ago, and people bring it out saying, well, scientists say fossilization takes millions of years. It doesn't.
Oh, no, it doesn't have to.
It can take hundreds of years if the conditions are right.
Right.
And in fact, fossilization is such a rare event, as we mentioned in the last segment. And we say rare because there's been how many bone-carrying mammals, animals living.
And we only have...
Yeah, how many fossils do we have?
Yeah, we have such a small fraction of that number.
Yeah, so fossilization is a rare event, and it takes very specific circumstances.
Yep.
But just because it's rare doesn't mean it takes, you know, millions of years or even hundreds of thousands of years or even tens of thousands of years for the actual fossilization to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Like, something might... like. A T-Rex might be 65 million years old, but it didn't take that long to fossilize. It wasn't right. in the fossilization process that whole time. That happened way long, you know, 64 million years ago.
Well, it may only have taken a few hundred years if it was in the right conditions.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and it may have taken 1,000 years, who knows? But you have to imagine it probably happens relatively quickly. Now, with something like a T-Rex, it probably... you know, it can take a little longer because it's hard to move those bones around, even through water action or other animals, things like that. But if you take in the whole taphonomic process, if you find a relatively intact skeleton that's been fossilized, then you know that it probably fossilized either relatively quickly or in isolation because it didn't have a chance to be dispersed.
Yeah, like it couldn't move for some reason.
Whereas if you find like a lot of prehuman paleoanthropological, like Homo erectus, you know, Australopithecus afarensis, Lucy.
Right.
Lucy was found all over this hillside because she was probably fossilized relatively intact, but was eroding out of a hillside.
Right.
So that action of the erosion and the rain coming down dispersed her bones.
Right.
And that's one of the final process. That's her fifth phase of taphonomy.
Just a dispersal.
Yeah, after she's been fossilized is the dispersal.
Yep.
So, and whatever else happens to it at that point as well.
Yep.
Anyway, in this area, hundreds of thousands of bone accumulations consisting of over 40 species have been identified, including humans.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying like prehumans or Neanderthals. I'm talking humans.
Yep.
Yeah. So if you haven't checked out the Heritage Daily article, check it out because it's really cool seeing the images of these lava tubes that they've mapped. They're just like super long and crazy tubes, and you can see the bone accumulations and
a couple walls and stuff in there too. Did they mention what those walls like? Were they naturally formed walls? I would assume.
No, this article didn't really get into it, and I didn't read the source article, so I don't really know. But I would imagine that it wasn't just hyenas that used this. Unless if it was full of like bones, maybe it would have been taboo to early humans because I wouldn't have wanted to go in there.
Oh, I would stay
despite the protection
very
and,
far.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, the lava system, researchers believe, just by analyzing the bones, was used as a den by hyenas for a period of about 7,000 years.
Mm.
So that's a really long time.
Yep.
And I imagine amongst the early humans, a lore would have been built up about those lava tubes.
Yeah,
like
probably.
You would have known that this is a place where things go to die.
Yeah.
I imagine it like the elephant graveyard in Lion King.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you don't want to go over there.
No, just stay away from there. It's a bad place.
It was all dark and, like, cold over there, but which literally describes nowhere in Africa. But anyway.
And, like, yeah, like, the weather changed when they crossed the line, even though, like, it was still, like, exposed. Yeah.
There's also evidence of hyenas. They died there, too, and probably fought amongst themselves, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And also, if a hyena died, I imagine another hyena would just drag it back into the den and eat it. I mean, why not?
Oh, do you think they're cannibals?
Well, I know they are.
Yeah.
I mean, they're carnivores.
Yeah.
So, anyway, the striped hyena that we know today, and its Latin name is actually hyena hyena, and it's spelled the Greek way, H-Y-A-E-N-A,
mm-hmm.
or the Latin way, sorry. Anyway, there's, I think, four four extant hyenas right now, but there have been many hundreds and hundreds of different types of hyenas. And the more docile dog-like hyena, there was a version of those that actually made it to North America, crossed the Bering Land Bridge and made it to North America. That died out. Mm-hmm. And there's been others. But then some of the more common hyenas that developed several million years ago are called actually bone-crushing hyenas. Mm. And if you look at their skulls, and I think there's pictures in this article, or the pictures might be in the regular article. Actually, it might have been just the research I was doing. Anyway, you look at these bone-crushing hyenas, they're called, and their jaws and their teeth, their molars, are just way over-exaggerated.
Oh, really?
And they just had insane force in their jaws. Insane. I mean, they saw evidence in the articles I was reading when I kind of deep dived on hyenas, not in this article, that hyenas were breaking elephant femurs.
Oh, man.
Like just latching on and just crushing down like a vice.
Wow.
Yeah, so.
I mean, I guess you have to if that's your food source, right?
Yeah, and there was one type of hyena. This one ended up dying out, I think. But there was one type of hyena that they're very evolutionarily moldable, it seems. Mm-hmm. Like, they're just like, whatever their food source is, they're going to adapt it, overcome. Mm. Because there was one that developed a ability to process the, what do they call it, turpin or something like that. It's the, like, bile-type byproduct that termites use in their nest making.
What?
And this hyena was able to eat termites. But not a lot of mammals could digest the termites because of that chemical.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, super gross.
That is really gross.
They're like,
but
hey,
interesting.
Look at the tasty termites. Yeah, so.
Wow.
Anyway, so that's hyenas. They're pretty cool. I tell you what, if you've ever been in the high desert, and we have in the last couple of months, you know, almost every night and morning, I would hear packs of
Coyotes. Yeah.
Which, if I had to guess, they're probably a distant relative or have a common ancestor with hyenas.
Probably.
I don't really know. They're both dog-like.
Yeah.
But anyway, the hyenas, when I spent 3 weeks in Africa back in 2005, the sound of the hyenas at night, and you could hear them, the packs of them.
Are they yippy like coyotes
They're yippy and they're weird and it's just terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to sleep to.
Yeah, they almost like squeal a little bit, kind of. Yeah.
Well, the hyenas and the lions are the reason why the camp that we were at, it was actually the camp that this field school that I was on, it was the camp that the Leakeys had set up. So Louis Leakey and Mary Leakey had both worked there. Mm-hmm. Mary Leakey's hut was there. Louis Leakey's hut was there. And that's where that's where we stayed. And there was only one entrance, and the rest of it was ringed by dead thorn bushes, basically.
Oh,
it was probably
for protection?
About a 6-foot-high hedge that nothing could get through.
Right.
And then we had Maasai warriors with their spears at the entrance, basically 24 hours a day.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, they'll come in looking for food.
Yeah.
And if they can't find it, they'll eat you because you're food.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know from Lion King that hyenas are aggressive.
And mean, laugh a lot.
And they laugh a lot. So. I mean, given what I know about hyenas, that totally makes sense.
I know. So that seems totally legit. We'll cite our sources later.
Definitely.
Elton John is one of our sources. Anyway.
Oh.
So anyway, the preservation in the lava tubes is really good compared to other places. I mean, it's like any cave system where it's going to be relatively environmentally controlled, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So it's going to have really good preservation.
And to be clear, are we talking about fossilized bones in these caves?
That is not clear.
Okay.
And I don't think we are.
Okay.
Because in order for something to fossilize, it needs to be buried. That is one hallmark of fossilization.
And these are not buried.
They're not buried. They're piles.
So how are they doing a taphonomic study if they're not?
Well, it's in the taphonomic process. The minute you die, your taphonomy starts.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You don't have to be fossilized, right?
So this is beginning stages, and if they were to get buried, then the process would go along.
Every single cemetery that is around you right now has bodies going through the taphonomic process.
Yeah. Also, they did mention that some of the tubes were collapsed, so I would imagine some of the bones did get buried, so maybe they were.
But did they get fossilized? I don't know, because it takes a certain amount of minerals, moisture, all kinds of things to do that mineral replacement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, they use these lava tubes around the world, and especially in this region, to really learn about what's called the paleoecology of a region, which means just the ancient ecological environment.
Right.
You know, what is it? What kind of animals? What kind of plants? All kinds of stuff, because you could even look at, just like you can look at human bones and teeth, you can look at animal bones and teeth, and there are humans found here, and you can learn a lot about their diet.
Yeah. So I would imagine like a whole pile of bones like this can give you a really good snapshot of all of the different species that were in an area and how they were potentially interacting too. So yeah.
And that's interesting. That's really important observation too, because I know when I was in Africa, the person who was leading the field school was also part of another field school that is done through Rutgers University in New Jersey. And I don't know if they're still doing this, but it was called the Olduvai Landscape Paleoanthropology Project. Mm-hmm. And basically their tagline was, the Leakeys spent 50 years getting a vertical chronology of East Africa, which means from, you know, now on back to 2.1 million years, they knew what was there.
Yeah.
Right. They had all the species, but they didn't know who those species lived with.
Right.
You know, so they brought in all these different experts in different things, paleoecology, paleoethnobotany, paleo, everything. If it has paleo in front of it, they brought an expert there.
To learn about the whole environment of the area, basically.
And they were basically digging around Olduvai Gorge in slices of time. Now, Olduvai Gorge is a very specific place where you can... because of the lava that's there, the layers, you can do potassium argon dating and some other things to specifically date the lava that's there. So you know the bottom and top end date of a layer because of its cap, right?
Right.
So they were going through and just picking 100,000 year or 50,000 year slices of time, which is pretty short in the evolutionary time scale, and saying, let's find everything.
Yeah.
What are the plants? What are the bugs? Yeah, what are the animals?
That's cool. That's really neat to get that like snapshot in time of an area. That's really, really cool.
Yeah. Super cool.
Yeah.
So
neat.
Anyway. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. There's a lot of neat things in here that you can deep dive on. I did some reading on taphonomy to brush up on that. Did some reading on hyenas to brush up on them. And it was all pretty cool. So I'm going to take this knowledge and I'm going to sell it for a whole bunch of Chinese coins.
I don't think you are, actually.
Well, we'll try it on the other side of the break. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to episode 134 of the Archaeology Show, where I make my millions selling knowledge about hyenas and bone-crushing activities.
Wait, you make your millions in ancient Chinese coins?
In ancient Chinese coins,
right?
Yes.
That's the only thing you'll accept as payment, is ancient Chinese coins.
That's true.
Okay, good luck with that.
All right.
Okay.
So, again, the original article that we're reading that we found this on, the popular article, is from Heritage Daily. However, the antiquity article from Cambridge University Press is also linked. So check that out if you want to see the original article. The article in Heritage Daily is called Ancient Coin Mint Discovered in China from Over 2,500 Years Ago.
That is old.
Yeah. So let's put this in time. This was found during excavations at Guangzhou, a city and administrative center in the Zheng State. Again, I'm going to pronounce all this wrong, so read the article. The Zheng State was a central regional power before the rise of Imperial China. So this is prior to the first emperor of China, when China was just kind of a plucky little country. No, I don't know what it was. Anyway, my big takeaway from this whole thing is the spade coins.
Yeah.
We always think of coins as round.
Yeah.
I remember when it just blew me away one time, and I think this was probably when I was in the Navy, that I saw a coin with a hole in it.
Oh,
yeah. I was like, what is this craziness? But it's still round.
Yeah, still round.
So coins have... I mean, I've seen old coins. I've seen pictures of really old coins. I've seen Roman coins. And they're always round.
Yeah.
But who decided they had to be round and why?
Yeah, I wonder if it's just because it's an easy shape to create. I don't know.
But super cool. The coins from this particular foundry or mint... They call them spade coins now because they look like a garden spade. They look like a trowel.
Yeah. And it's weird, though. Like, why would they go through all the effort to make a coin in that shape? Because it would take a lot more effort than just, like, hammering out something roughly circular.
If you had a hard time getting your writing to be defined on a coin, what's the next best way to identify it as a regional specialty?
Oh, it's to give it a special shape.
It's going to be a shape, right?
Yeah.
Because shapes are easy.
Yep.
All you got to do is, if you already know how to smelt and do this,
yeah,
then it's easy enough to just make the shape.
Yeah, I guess that's a really good point.
Funny thing is, I don't think this article ever said what these were made out of.
Oh, really? No, I don't remember reading that either.
Wow, I didn't even write that down because they didn't say it.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
The article is very short.
Yeah, there's not a lot to it.
So I definitely recommend reading the...
They kind of phoned it in.
The original one. Yeah, they just... Yeah. The picture is really interesting. So that was sort of the meat of it, really.
Yep, they say that this is the... I'm going to say exactly what they said. This is the oldest form of commodity money used during the Zhao dynasty of China. But really, you have to reinterpret that as the oldest form that we have found.
Correct.
Because that you always have to say that we've discovered.
Yeah.
That's something nobody ever puts in an article, but you have to mentally add that at the end of every sentence.
Yeah. Even if they don't say it, just know that there could be something older, but there's no evidence of it yet.
Right. Of course, when the first emperor of China took over in 2021 BC, they were immediately abolished. Because I'm sure the emperor had their own own coins.
Probably back to the plain old round coins.
There we go.
Distributed throughout everywhere.
I don't know if they were round or not.
I don't know either.
Anyway, really cool. And I just, the time scales of these things, like we see, we were just at a place that I grew up going out and having a meal at, this old little drive-in on the way to where we're at now. And I always remember going there as a kid, and I saw on their sign, family owned and operated since 1968. And I'm like, ooh, that's a super long time.
Mm-hmm.
That's like older than me. And, you know, how did they manage to keep this in the family for that long and do all those things? But this foundry that eventually became the mint started around 770 BC, but mostly produced ritual vessels, weapons, and tools. It wasn't until about 150 years later that minting activities actually appeared.
That's a long time later.
That's a long time later.
That it was producing metal. Foundry means metal, right? So they were producing metal objects.
Yeah, metal could be presumably gold, silver. Again, even looking at these spades, I don't know what kind of things they were. How do we know they're... Well, coins don't have to be precious all the time. They just have to represent money.
Yeah, exactly.
Like dollar bills aren't... You know, they're only worth a dollar because we say they are.
Right. I don't know. And I think it really depends on the culture, too, because some would absolutely use precious metal because it was important for money to be something that was also precious. But I don't really know about ancient China and how they felt about their money and precious metals and how that sort of relationship works together.
I think it's interesting that I'm looking at this thinking, wow, that would be easily copyable. Like, why couldn't you just print your own money, basically?
Mm-hmm.
But it's back in a time frame when the knowledge of smelting and doing all that was probably a closely guarded secret.
Yeah, probably.
Because, I mean, not only just for stuff like this, but for the business aspect of it, like you didn't want your everyday Joe Schmo putting up a forge in the backyard and making their own stuff.
Oh, yeah, you absolutely couldn't. And that gives some credence to the idea that it was a special shape because to identify where the money was coming from, but also because it would make it really hard for somebody else to copy and reproduce and flood the market. We couldn't have inflation now.
Yeah, there's definitely some definable, like, angles and points and lines and stuff on these spade-shaped coins.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, too, they're the one that they show here, I was going to say two, but it's just different angles of the same one. The one that they show here in four different images is broken off, and it was pointed down at the end, which I can imagine those broke off relatively easily. It looks like if this is a common centimeter scale, too, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, they're about 6 centimeters across, so, you know, give or take a few inches, you know, 2 to 3 inches. And I guess that would make them probably about unbroken, probably 20 centimeters high. So they were not small.
Yeah, that's pretty good size.
This thing would have held in your hand pretty well.
Yeah.
And it's a coin. It's currency. Yeah.
I wish we knew more about it. Like, how many of those would you need to be rich? And and if it wasn't very many, like if you just needed a handful and it's like, you're rich.
Yeah.
Then what... How did they break that currency down? Because poor people had money, too. They just didn't have as much of it. So
it looks like you could legit stab somebody with this, too.
I know. Yeah. I wish we knew more about the structure of their coin system, basically.
Right.
It's interesting.
Yeah, prior research in coinage and money suggested that the first were issued by merchants, making it easier to trade and transport. So they would actually make their own coins, issue them with people as a, you know, as an IOU kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, like, a, or you owe me.
Right.
You know, either way. But and to actually count up what they have, like a representation of their wealth. However, this particular mint, and again, this is, seems like kind of a stretch to me, but it could just be the distillation of this article into a, you know, a quick little article to read. But this mint is close to the outer edge of a city near the gates to the administrative inner city, indicating that the government was more involved and not merchants, because merchants were in very specific places in a city.
Right, right.
And not right there.
Right.
So, who knows?
And real quick, I was just skimming through the source article, and it's a bronze foundry. That,
oh, bronze.
Yeah, yeah, that created these coins. And all the other items that were created in this area were all bronze. Okay. So I guess we can assume that the coins were bronze as well. So,
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess if you take a closer look at the picture of this spade thing here, it does look a little greenish.
A little greenish.
As bronze would do.
Yeah, yeah.
It also looks coated. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I'm not
sure. Maybe it's just a really thick patina.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
The they found molds, too, it sounds like. So they've got, like, the actual... That's how they know that it came to a point on either side. I mean, you can kind of guess based on the shape of that picture, but the mold showed them exactly how it was shaped. Mm-hmm. So... finding that was really cool, and it also shows that it was where they were producing these, because if you don't have the mold, you can't really be for sure that something's being was produced there. But in this case, they did find them, so
okay,
it's very neat.
Anyway, as I mentioned, you know, they say that this could have been a government run, not merchant run, but that is purely speculative based on its location. They wanted to point out that the affiliation of the foundry has not been confirmed, so. Anyway, check out the article. Super short, but you can link to the actual scholarly article or journal article. Is that completely open, or just have the abstract?
It is. It's completely open. Yeah,
nice.
It's definitely getting into the weeds a little bit here. I'm trying to like skim it just to see if I can learn anything else. But there's some really cool pictures in there, more than what's in the really short article that we found. That article is a great overview, but this one definitely goes much more in depth. And it talks about, like, the handle, the spade handle was, like, a there's a clay piece that would have been inserted there for the... Yeah, so it was, these coins were a mix of the clay handle and then the bronze spade part.
Yeah.
Which is, again, interesting because it's so complicated for one piece of coin. Coinage?
Well,
one piece of money? Whatever.
We're thinking of it as a coin, and we've got pennies in our pockets, right? So we're kind of downplaying it, but this was probably the only money, the only representation of something else.
Right.
You know?
Very,
so.
Very interesting. I would love to know more about the structure of their society, what they were using these coins for. Was it only for big purchases? Like, you only use these coins when you're buying a house or property or something like that? Or was it, were they in everyday use and did everybody have them? I just would love to know more about that because I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, that is about it. I want to take a minute to comment on an email that we had come in. So this actually has nothing to do with our show, but I thought since it came from one of our longtime fans and a person that writes in all the time, that I would just mention it on the show here because maybe other people are concerned with us and what we're doing. But this person writes that, I'll just paraphrase here a little bit, says, it occurred to me that you and your partner are wandering the backwoods and that is dangerous. How do you deal with it? He said, I know many people go around in RVs, but they seem to be in RV parks a lot or Walmart. True. He just wants to know, how do we avoid people and animals breaking into our RV, keeping away biker gangs or the Taliban or aliens or Bigfoot or angry indigenous people? I know, all kinds of things, right?
Right.
So how do we do it? And I would say that over the last 14 months or so that we've been doing this, to be honest, in that amount of time frame, we've predominantly been in RV parks.
Yeah.
And RV parks are typically, if not patrolled by actual security, it's just a different vibe in the park.
Like,
people can't generally just come in.
Yeah. And there are a lot of RV parks that have a lot of homeless people in them, or vagrants, or people that might, somebody that you might expect could break into your home.
Yeah.
I don't want to generalize or stereotype here, but some of them are just, you just stay away from the ones that look like they have people in it that you would be worried about breaking into your stuff.
Right, right.
So that's what we've done. And we just got our solar set up. So we haven't really been off grid too much because we haven't had the power capability to do that. So, but we're going to go more off grid now, and we'll have to really focus on making sure that we're going to areas that are safe. And if we are leaving the RV, because we have a car too, if we leave the RV to go somewhere, we got to make sure that we're leaving it somewhere safe. So,
yeah, I think a lot of the boondocking places I've seen, especially down in like the Southwest and some BLM land and stuff like that, there's usually a number of other people out there too.
Yeah.
And if you just, like any neighborhood, if you look at the people around you and say, these are the kind of people I wouldn't mind hanging out with, then fine. I mean, to be honest, if I see a bunch of old, I hate to stereotype, but like broken down school buses or 48-year-old Winnebagos, I'm probably not going to stay there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's nothing against those people. It's just,
you want to feel safe.
You want to feel safe. And if it looks like you might have something they need, I'm not going to say they're just going to steal from you, but you just got to kind of play that by ear. And
you just don't know. And you, all you can do is visually assess an area and decide whether or not it is going to be safe for you to stay.
Right.
And as far as keeping animals out of here,
we haven't been super good about that.
No.
We've had mice occasionally.
Yeah, we've had some mice get in, and insects.
Yeah,
insects are a thing. Yeah, we do our best.
We always leave the door closed.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, we keep things closed up as much as possible, but also it's an RV, and like you want to be with the outside air, you know? So you can't close it up too much. But
yeah, we're actually at a relative's house right now in a small town, well, smallish town. And I feel, just because I know the people that live in this town, because I grew up here, I feel less safe here than I have in most RV parks. Like, I feel like we could easily get robbed. Somebody's going to come steal our bikes and break a window in our car. Like, I wouldn't put that past anybody.
Oh.
It's totally unfounded. But I feel, it's not real, but I feel less safe. You know what I mean? That's a testament to most RV parks.
Yeah.
You know?
At least the ones that we've stayed in. And Thousand Trails, we do have to give a big shout out to them, because we stayed in a lot of Thousand Trails and Encore parks over the last year.
Yeah.
Because we have a membership there, and they always feel very safe. Even the ones that are like super crowded and have a lot of people in them, I still have never felt like they were unsafe or had people in it that I was worried about stealing stuff from us. So
yeah, I think we pay a few hundred bucks a year for our Thousand Trails membership. We've got kind of one of the lower
Yeah, we have the lowest version they offer.
But still, that allows us 2 weeks for free.
Yeah.
And then 7 days out, and then 2 weeks for free.
Yeah.
In a decent park with full hookups, power, sewer, water usually, sometimes cable.
Yep.
And sometimes Wi-Fi. And that's not too shabby. Between that and Harvest Host, and we've never had a problem at a Harvest Host.
No.
Look up Harvest Host if you haven't. You pay, I think, 100 and something a year these days to get basically access to a list of wineries, breweries, farms, museums, attractions.
Golf courses,
places with something they sell and a parking lot or at least one spot for an RV.
Yeah.
You know, that's obviously the minimum.
And the idea is you patronize.
Yeah, you stay there for free.
Their store, whatever they're selling, you buy something from them.
That doesn't really work out for us a lot. We stayed at a couple Harvest Hosts in the last week or so, and I think we easily spent like $300 in wine.
Oh my God, it was all such good wine, though.
Such good wine.
I don't feel bad about that at all.
I know. We ended up paying like $60 a night for those accommodations, but
yeah,
you know, whatever.
That's fine, whatever.
Yeah, we don't do
great
that all the
wine.
Time.
No.
After that, we're about to not pay for anything for the next like 4 weeks.
Yeah.
So it kind of is a give and take.
It is.
Anyway, so that's what we do. I thank you for the concern, and basically don't be, because it's awesome and it's great. And the RVing community in general, of really the people who are full-timer traveler RVs, the community of those people is just really good. From the huge fancy class A's that people are driving down the road, all the way down to, you know, the people that are living in their camper vans, like the movie Nomadland.
Yep.
You know, all those people are just like a community that take care of each other.
Yeah, they definitely do.
Yeah.
So it's a cool lifestyle. And COVID-19 wise too, like we can be as separate from people as we want to be. So we haven't really felt concerned, even in the height of the pandemic, that we were being exposed, because we could just stay in our RV. We shut the door, stay in our RV, and we don't have to see anybody.
And we do that a lot because I work a lot and just sit in here. And if we need to go somewhere, we take the shuttlecraft out and we go on an away mission.
That's
and
right.
then we come back to the RV, the mothership.
Yeah.
So
that's how it is.
Anyway, that's enough of that. If you want to write in and tell us how crazy we are living in an RV, or you have a good story you want us to talk about, then chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com or comment on this show wherever you see it, either on archpodnet.com/archaeology/134 or anywhere else you find the show. All right. Thanks, everybody. And we'll see you next week.
Adios.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.archpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at archpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.